For 7 years, I had the privilege each summer of being a counselor at a two-week summer theology institute for incoming college freshmen on the topic of theological explorations of vocation. And many of us throughout our lives have some of those vocational questions, but they can be especially real for incoming college freshmen. And our goal was to equip these young people with tools, with frameworks, with experiences to help them begin and continue to discern their particular gifts and how their particular gifts might line up with how they may be particularly equipped to make the world a better place through their life. Because how we choose to spend our time and talent, that is the thing on which we bet our lives. That's what we're betting our lives on, how we choose to spend our lives. And one classic definition of vocation is that you are called to that place where your deep gladness meets the world's deep hunger. That's where you can most beneficially and fruitfully spend your time in your life, where your deep gladness meets the world's deep hunger. And one of the ways that we most powerfully each year invited those young people to encounter the world's deep hunger was by taking them on a poverty tour of the city where we were, which was Greenville, South Carolina. Now, up to this point, most of the campers, you know, in the orientation of the first few days, we'd taken them to downtown Greenville. Have any of you been to downtown Greenville in recent years? It's changed a lot in the last decade or more. Probably two decades, but we take them downtown. There's this revitalized, refurbished downtown, very similar to downtown Greenville. There's a big park, so, you know, they're playing frisbee, they're eating ice cream, they're having a great time. You know, it's in the foothills of the Blue Ridge, it's beautiful. Then about a week later, we take them back, and we put them on a bus, and it's led by the director of one of the local nonprofits who's been working for decades to try to wrestle with issues of poverty in Greenville County and beyond. So we take them, you know, on a similar route to downtown Greenville, and then you go just one block over where it's, you know, the kind of the trees are blocking, you can't see past the tree line, and all of a sudden those smoothly paved wide roads with the beautifully manicured sidewalks, they totally disappear, and it becomes a one-lane road, a road that if a car is just parked on the side of the road, there's no way an ambulance could get through. And there are dilapidated houses and buildings that you just would never see if you didn't live in that neighborhood. So it's hidden from the view of most citizens who might do something about it. And he would also show us the clear evidence of where he would drive under a bridge and park and show us clear evidence of pallets where individuals or families had slept the night before and likely would return, and take us to bamboo fields that were just kind of random in Greenville, South Carolina, but bamboo fields that where you could go just a little bit into the bamboo fields and see some of the times the families were there. That's where they would be during the day because they had nowhere else to go, just on the periphery of that bustling and revitalized downtown. The summer of 2001 was the first year of those 7 years that I led that You Bet Your Life camp, and we were figuring out many of the details as we went. And one of the factors that we hadn't fully accounted for was just how devastated emotionally and viscerally some of those incoming high school freshmen were with what they saw. So we had debriefed a little on the bus, but we realized we couldn't just go back to the dining hall and eat dinner and send them to bed. So we gathered them in a big circle in the parking lot. And the real breakthrough came when one of the counselors who had actually volunteered, so the director of that nonprofit that I mentioned, he had volunteered. It was called United Ministries, and it was a lot of congregations had come together to sort of fund this nonprofit. And he had volunteered there, and he had confronted and dealt with this, of confronting many, many families who are wrestling with these issues, these huge issues of poverty and homelessness. And he said the story that he had found reassuring, that he had found on the wall of that nonprofit, was this one. Some of you may have heard it before. A child is walking along the ocean and sees a beach where thousands and thousands of starfish have washed ashore. She keeps walking, and further along, she comes across a woman who, from time to time, is bending down, picking up one of those starfish and throwing them into the ocean. And she says, "Why are you throwing those starfish into the ocean?" And she says, "Well, the sun is up and the tide is going out, and if I don't throw them back into the sea, then they'll dry up and they'll die." But the child says, "There's so many starfish, you know, you're barely making a difference." And so the woman, as she responds, bends down, picks up another starfish, gently throws it back into the ocean, and says to the child, "It made a difference to that one." My friend found comfort in that story, and when he was overwhelmed with immense issues of how big poverty is in our nation, in our cities, and in our world, he would sometimes just say, "I need to stop thinking about that and make a difference in one person's life. To help at least one person get food for the next month. To help one person get the water turned back on for their family. To help one person just have my full attention who's feeling lost. To help one person get clothes for their first job interview. To help one person get that prescription they desperately need. Or to visit one person who's in prison and not sure how to get out or what they're going to do when they get out." So that's what he would do when he was overwhelmed, to start with just helping one person. There's a lot of wisdom in that starfish story, but here's another story that's become an equally important touchstone for me as I've continued to reflect on these large social problems. Imagine a large river fueled by a large waterfall just up the road. At the bottom of this waterfall, hundreds of people, as you come up, are working frantically to try to save those who have fallen into the river, and many of them are drowning. That there's this hubbub of activity that you come across. And as the people along the shore are trying to rescue as many people as possible, one person starts to run away, and one individual looks up and says, "Where are you going? There's so many people here that need help. People are drowning." And that individual says, "I'm going upstream to find why so many people have fallen in the river." The starfish story reminds us that at minimum, we can make real, immediate difference in people's lives with simple acts of loving kindness. But the river story reminds us that it's not enough to just be the change we want to see in the world. We have to start there. That may be the most important first step. But in addition to working on the one-on-one level, we need to eventually address the larger systemic issues. But those are much more difficult to tackle. In the words of one Catholic liberation theologian, a former Archbishop of Brazil, "When I give food to the poor, they call me a saint for doing that, for helping individuals and feeding them. But when I ask why so many people are poor in the first place, they don't want to listen to me, and they call me a communist." Or as I said last week, I'm incredibly grateful and proud of this congregation and a number of other congregations in this community. I think we're up to 12 or 14 at this point, for coming together to form a family emergency shelter for families in our community who find themselves temporarily homeless and without a place to spend the night. We're right to begin with providing shelter for families with children in our community who right now need a place to stay that's safe and clean. But we also need, over time, to say, what are we learning through this process? What are we hearing from these individuals? And how might that inform us as we maybe look to begin advocating for systemic change in lack of jobs that pay a living wage, in lack of affordable housing? Along these lines, at this year's past UU General Assembly, I was challenged in particular by two speakers. The first was Dr. Marshall Ganz. He's the senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard University's Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation. Ganz's father was a rabbi. His mother was a teacher. He grew up in the San Joaquin Valley of California. Some of you may recognize that if you've read The Grapes of Wrath. That's the terminus of that book, that Dust Mowl migration, is to the San Joaquin Valley. Interestingly, with his experience, his mother as a teacher, that book was banned for many years. They didn't want it read in that area. It was too controversial. It called out too many of those systemic issues. Ganz graduated from high school in that auspicious year of 1960 when John F. Kennedy was elected president. And in those heady times, Ganz, the son of a rabbi, dropped out of Harvard after his junior year to go be a full-time member and organizer in the civil rights movement for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as SNCC. Following the passage of the Voting Rights Act, he returned to his home state of California in 1965 instead of going back to Harvard to join Cesar Chavez and the efforts to unionize California farm workers. After 16 years with the United Farm Workers, Ganz felt the need to deepen his intellectual understanding. So he'd been organizing for two decades. So what have I learned? How might I reflect on that in theory so that it might be modeled and adapted for others? So he wanted to supplement and extend his on-the-ground experience. So after a 28-year leave of absence, Gans returned to Harvard, completed his undergraduate degree in history and government, got a master's in public administration and a PhD in sociology in 2000. He jokes that he's part of the Harvard class of 6492. So 64/92. More recently, Gans famously consulted with the Obama campaign, the first one. Some of you may remember hearing about that in the late spring of 2007 to help then-candidate Obama better tell his story and to learn from Gans's experience to help set up intensive community organizing-style training camps in which young people would be trained to tell Obama's story, to spread a message, and to generate a true grassroots movement. Now, of course, the rest is history and the reason we have President Obama and not just candidate Obama. But it's also worth noting that President Obama's famous slogan, "Yes, we can," long before President Obama started using that, Cesar Chavez was using it in 1972. So, "Yes, we can" used to be "Si se puede," as for the rallying cry of the United Farm Workers. And Dr. Gans, in reflecting on his decades of organizing experience through his doctoral work and through his teaching at Harvard, has written a book called Why David Sometimes Wins. David doesn't always win, but when David does win, he wanted to look at that and what can we learn from that to help David win more. Referring to that ancient biblical tale, first heard probably by Gans from his father, the rabbi. David and Goliath is how it is typically known. And in that classic story, the Philistine champion, the giant Goliath, had been taunting the Israelites for 40 days. So the gathered Israelite army with all their armor and battle, they had been afraid to go into battle with this giant Goliath, and he'd been taunting them for 40 days. And suddenly this young shepherd boy, David, comes up and says, "Well, if no one else will fight Goliath, I will." Perhaps foolhardy, but he said, you know, he thought, something else needs to happen. We're just sitting here. And so the soldier said, "All right, well, if you're going to do that, let's give you the best suit of armor." So they gave him the king's armor, the king's chainmail, the king's sword, the king's helmet. But that young shepherd boy, David, couldn't even walk with all of that on. So he took it all off and he realized, "I can't defeat Goliath on Goliath's terms. That's why these soldiers haven't been able to do it for 40 days. So he looked around and he saw a nearby riverbed, and in it he saw 5 smooth stones. And that was something as a shepherd boy he knew about, that he had to defend his sheep from wild animals using his slingshot. And so David defeated Goliath by surprising him with a rock to the forehead, stunned Goliath, knocked him over, and, as the story goes, killed him with Goliath's own sword. And to relate that story to the 20th century, prior to Chavez's work in California, there had been 3 waves of farm labor organizing since 1900. David had tried 3 times to defeat Goliath and had failed. But like David, Chavez succeeded where others failed because he thought about the situation differently, didn't try to defeat Goliath on Goliath's own terms, and was more motivated. So he looked around and he thought, he used the resources at hand in novel ways. Cesar Chavez used to say, "Power makes you stupid." In Gans's words, the Goliaths of this world arrogantly come to rely on overwhelming resources to keep their advantage. But that's exactly what creates the opportunities for disrupting Davids of this world. So what does that mean for us? Well, as with the starfish story, we know that we can and should begin by doing what we can for individuals. But if you want to take on the Goliath and start to change the system, such as, you know, going from the family emergency shelter to thinking about homelessness more largely, then to think about not only why there are, not only feed the poor, but why are there so many poor people, then what we might be able to learn from the archetypal David, the same thing that Chavez and Gans and Obama have learned, is that we might begin to look at what we uniquely have access to, and that is our liberal religious tradition. One example of that is that the most well-known and prominent UU theologian of the 20th century is James Luther Adams, or was James Luther Adams. He's affectionately known usually as JLA. And he has an essay where he wrote about the 5 smooth stones of religious liberalism That's different from political liberalism, but of theological liberalism. And that's he means that as a reference to the five smooth stones of that David biblical story. So for JLA, his five stones, the first one is that we see revelation as continuous. We don't just think that the way things were in the past, that we just need to get back to some golden age. We really are open to the present and to the future. And so as a liberal religious tradition, we're not locked into the past. And it makes us particularly David-like in our openness to creative innovations. The second of those five smooth stones is that we believe not in coercion, but in mutual free consent. Goliath models rely on a top-down, locked-in hierarchy. But our fifth principle commitment to the democratic process keeps us open to all voices, including those small, David-like voices from the margins that can sometimes point us to previously unforeseen ways forward. The third smooth stone for JLA is the moral obligation to direct one's effort toward the establishment of a just and loving community. So for JLA, the Goliaths of this world, let me say it this way, insist that the way things are, which of course unduly favor the Goliaths, right? The way things are is how they got so big and strong and powerful in the first place. They want to say, that's just the way it is. That's the way it always has to be. But the successful Davids of this world commit to changing the world for better and persist until they shift the system closer to the realization of the beloved community. That's why Chavez succeeded where others failed, because he just didn't give up. It's not a guarantee, but it's often that necessary ingredient that makes the difference. The fourth smooth stone is the denial of the Immaculate Conception, not of Jesus, we deny that too, but the denial of the Immaculate Conception of virtue. In other words, the world doesn't magically bend toward justice and become more virtuous. It only happens when we freely choose to come together and through our collective effort bend the world toward love and justice. And the fifth smooth stone is optimism. We persist in the hope of the possibility, against all odds, of moving the world incrementally toward peace and justice. If you want the advanced SAT word for any of you high schoolers out there that are studying, meliorism is the classic liberal word, like ameliorate, that we are meliorists. We believe that it can get better. So, it's on the SAT, let me know, and so I'll take some credit. To briefly name what such a process might look like on the ground here in Frederick, I mentioned earlier that there were two speakers at this year's UUGA. There were tons of speakers at the last General Assembly, but two in particular stood out to me and challenged me personally and seemed particularly relevant for us here. The first was Dr. Gans. The second was my colleague, the Reverend Mark Stringer, in his Sunday sermon to thousands of UUs. I'll link to that sermon in the manuscript version of this sermon, and if you would like to listen to it or read it, but I'll summarize it briefly for you. Reverend Stringer spoke movingly about what he has learned in his community of First Unitarian of Des Moines, Iowa, of reaching across cultural as well as class as well as theological lines to try to change the community. Now, one of the things they've learned is that they can't always partner across theological lines to work on some issues. So like same-sex marriage, they had to go that alone with theologically liberal congregations. But they found with things like Habitat for Humanity, a broad base of congregations can get on board with every human being deserves a simple, decent place to live. And that was sort of the essential message, is that sometimes we theological liberals can just be a voice crying in the wilderness and get very little done other than naming what we think is the right way forward. And what he is challenging us, and all of us Unitarian Universalists, is to be more ready to partner, to go as long and as far as we can in partnership, and then on the side to also work on those issues where we might have to go it alone. Closer to home, similar coalitions have been built in Montgomery County and Baltimore County and D.C. using things like the Industrial Area Foundation models that Gans and Chavez and others help build. So I think there's ways we can learn from what others have done to build a similar model here in Frederick County, and that this family emergency shelter might be the seed of something that could be long-term and lasting to build greater social, economic, and environmental justice in our community. And as we explored last week, our greatest hope for change comes not from independence, but from interdependence. We need one another, not just in the diversity that's in this room, but in the full diversity that's in our community. We're stronger together. In that spirit, for now, I'll leave you with these words, known as the Franciscan blessing from the tradition of St. Francis of Assisi, who is known for his work with the poor and work for peace. He writes, "May you be blessed with discomfort. May you be blessed with discomfort at easy answers, at half-truths, at superficial relationships, that you might live deep within your heart. May you be blessed with anger. Blessed with anger at injustice, at oppression and exploitation of people. May that anger sustain and feed your work for justice for all people. May you harness anger in the work of love. May you be blessed with tears. Tears to shed for those who suffer from pain, hunger, and homelessness and rejection, that you might reach out your hand to help and comfort them. And may you be blessed with enough foolishness to believe that you can make a difference in this world, that together we might do what others say cannot be done."